Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm Donna Loring. Today is part two of our America 250th conversation. We continue with Dr. Harold Prince, Dr. Darren Ranko, and Ashiel Crofton McDonald, ambassador of the Houlton Band of Maliseet Indians. Today I want to pick up where we left off the last time. This is we're talking about the 250th anniversary of the American government. We, last time, our first show, we talked about the Orono visit in 1775, and then we talked about the Watertown Treaty. So today we're going to pick up from that. The Americans won the revolution. They created a new nation. But the Wabanaki nations were already here as distinct political peoples. So what happened once they won and once they didn't need us anymore? So Harold, I'm just going to let you step in and start this.
Good afternoon, Donna and Darren and Zeke. It's a pleasure to be with the three of you again. I'm pleased also to further discuss a key historical event that took place 250 years ago in July 1776. And that is the fact that this was the very first United States Indian Treaty. It's rarely mentioned by any of the legal historians, and there's a reason for that. Because the United States government was then still in formation. In other words, a lot of the key elements of the political structure of the Federal Republic were being placed in situ, if you will, by negotiations that happened in the Second Congress in Philadelphia. And then in the subsequent time when the Revolutionary War came to an end in 1783. And so this is an event that we are talking about today, which is the Treaty of Watertown of 1776. And the significance of that treaty is not only that it was the first signed by the United States, and it was almost by accident, because while the Wabanaki, the Eastern Wabanaki delegation had sailed from Machias in eastern Maine to Massachusetts and came to Watertown by horse carriages. They, at that time, it was not yet known that the Declaration of Independence had been signed in Philadelphia on the 4th of July. That news at that time traveled slowly, and even in Massachusetts, that was not yet known until about a week later. Let alone in Machias, which took, of course, another week or so before that news would reach Machias, because it's about a 5-6 day sail from Salem, Massachusetts, for example, to Machias. And then, of course, from there, if you want to reach the St. John River, that would be another couple of days, 3-4 days, if the winds were with you. This is all in the age before steam, and that meant that people were dependent on the winds, and a journey might quickly take double the amount of time than normal might have been in good sailing conditions. So in July 1776, an event took place when 10 Eastern Wabanaki, 6 of the Maliseet and 4 of the Mi'kmaq, sailed from Machias to Salem. And they came with a complex mission, because by that time, the war had started, the Revolutionary War had started a year and a half earlier, almost. It started badly for the American Revolutionary Army because it was defeated at the Battle of Bunker Hill in about May 1775. The American Revolutionary Army was rightfully afraid that the revolt might fail. And that meant, of course, that because an uprising against the British crown, that a lot of people would be hanged. And in particular, the major leaders, the so-called patriot leaders, the rebel leaders, would be hanged. So they were not only concerned about the British troops, which were concentrated along the coast, and at various forts in the deep interior in Quebec province and a little bit further on the Ohio River. But they were also particularly concerned what would happen with the indigenous nations that had either recently been crushed or were not yet crushed, but had every reason to be afraid of being crushed. So it was a big dilemma for the tribal leaders from multiple nations all along the American frontiers, what they would have to do in order to survive. So it's a mistake to think that this was a love for either the British or the French or the American revolutionaries that motivated the indigenous leaders. First and foremost, their responsibility was survival in very difficult circumstances. And that caused a lot of discussion in the tribal councils because it was very difficult to predict where the winds of fate would bring them. It was completely unpredictable and could have gone any direction. So when the Maliseet chief that Zeke later can talk about more in detail, but when Chief Ambrose Bear, who was probably the so-called second chief, the vice chief of the Maliseet Nation at the time, under Chief Tomah, who was elder, both were elderly man by that time and had earned their spurs, so to speak. But clearly made a determination that Chief Bear would side with the Americans. But he came with an agenda. And the agenda, again, as I mentioned before, was first and foremost the survival of the Maliseet. And he had a number of issues. One was that the trade embargo that was the result of the British American conflict that choked off a lot of the people in the coast, not only in terms of the lumber trade and the fish trade, which was important for, in particular, for Eastern Maine, but also for the American Indians who were fur traders and depended on the fur trade for the commodities that they had come to depend on. So that flow was interrupted because of the embargo, as well as because of the hostilities between the British who controlled the water and the Americans who had barely any navy to speak of. I don't want to get into the details, but that's kind of obvious. And so that was one thing. The other thing was that was on the list of Chief Ambrose Bear and his people was that they had been deprived of Roman Catholic missionaries, in particular French missionaries, and that was also on the agenda. The third one was, other than the trade and the missionary, was that the St. John Valley, after the expulsion of the French Acadians in 1755, many of whom were expelled to what is now Louisiana and New Orleans area, but others came to other parts of the French dominions, but some had escaped to Quebec. And they had come back after the Treaty of 1763 that ended the Sixth Anglo-Wabanaki War. They came back into New Brunswick, but they settled into the St. John Valley and they began to hunt on Maliseet territory. And that was also on the list of concerns that Chief Ambrose Bear had, that he, in case of the alliance with the Americans, wanted to make sure that, just like what the Penobscot Chief Orono had marked, that they would drive out the settlers who were illegally invading indigenous lands. So there was another point on his agenda. And then finally, and importantly, there had been a series of exchanges in the wake of Chief Orono's visit to Watertown in 1775, on the 21st of June, 1775. Maliseet chiefs, both Tomah and Ambrose Bear, had traveled to the Penobscot, met with the Penobscot on above the falls, and then met American Patriot delegates there at the trading post on the where now is Bangor, roughly. And they began to basically message to Massachusetts, the revolutionary government, that they would that they had concerns and would be ready to proceed with an alliance, like Chief Orono had just agreed to in June 1775. And so that then led to a letter from the revolutionary government in that time in Watertown, because the British controlled Boston at the time. And also later, a letter from General Washington himself in February or March, yeah, February 1776. So that's about 5 months or so before Chief Ambrose Bierce and his fellow Eastern Wabanaki set sail from Machias to Salem and then by horse carriage to Watertown. And that letter from George Washington is very important because he had great stature at the time. In essence, when Chief Bear came aboard the sloop that sailed him and his comrades from Machias to Salem, he had with him a the Parchment Treaty of 1760 with him that was concluded with the English. He had with him a sword and a pistol that had been given him by a fur trader on the Lower St. John who acted as an agent for the British governor in Halifax. He also had a so-called gorget, which is like a silver neck piece engraved with the likings of the British King George III and his wife, as well as the coat of arms of the British royal crown. And so he had all these things with him, which are clearly indicating that the mission was not just about trading posts, but also a political diplomatic mission of great concern. And he brought them as gifts, in particular the pistol and the sword, as tokens, symbolic tokens of a military alliance that they were willing to fight on the side of the Revolutionary Army. And that triggered off a whole series of events that maybe Zeke would like to address because he's been studying this.
Ezekiel, good.
I can take over from there, Willie Wynn Harold. I think one of the points that I think I would add is, well, I guess timing. I know Harold mentioned this, but the original reason why the delegates from Wolstogoy Nation and the Mi'kmaq Nation were there, it was prior to understanding of the Declaration of Independence and the formation of the United States. And one of the things that I personally traced through time in my research was the impact and importance of trade. And one of the big points in the Treaty of 1760 that predated Watertown was a trade agreement and the exclusive access to the beaver trade. And those agreements were being neglected, were being broken. And I think one of the main reasons why they went down there was to secure a more profitable trade agreement from a lot of ways because of the letter that was sent from George Washington and a previous letter from Massachusetts acknowledging that this is a problem and that they would provide access to supplies and importantly ammunition for hunting and all things that had been denied in the embargo that Harold had mentioned. And now I think the delegates from the Wolstogoy Nation and delegates from the Mi'kmaq Nation went down with different goals and different levels of authority. So which ultimately led to problems down the road. So the chief Wolstogoy chief Ambrose Bierce, I believe to a certain extent was empowered to enter into a wartime treaty. This was a wartime treaty to go to war. In the years directly prior, the Wolstogoy Nation had chosen to attack a British settlement along the Wolstog River, Majorville, and that is an attack, notably the trading the truck house operator, a man named John Anderson, and took him captive and took some supplies away from him and burned his truck house down. And we're ready to go to war with Great Britain to renew this very ancient conflict, but I don't. But the Mi'kmaq weren't, and that was pretty decisively demonstrated when the Watertown Treaty was written. It was written in English, wasn't translated to Wolosuque, and then from my understanding, wasn't translated to French either, despite the negotiations themselves happening in French through primarily from my understanding there was one Mi'kmaq man on the Wabanaki side who spoke French And later, described himself as the only translator, and suggested that the parties were not understanding each other. So later, after the terms of the Waratah Treaty were published, and the Wolskoi Nation, the Mi'kmaq Nation delegates had returned home, the collection of Mi'kmaq chiefs wrote a letter essentially explaining that the terms of the Waratah Treaty were not something that they supported. That the Watertown Treaty itself declared that there would be 600 warriors to go fight alongside George Washington in upstate New York, which is was not accurate, and not something that the Mi'kmaq chiefs explained as not something that they could realistically do. They couldn't send their warriors away from their home villages, and if they did that, Nova Scotia and Great Britain would attack their home villages, and they needed their warriors at home to protect from that. That was part of the reason why they also said that they called them the young men, and the character of chiefs were not empowered to speak on their behalf. There's actually a very complex and well-established tradition of treaty making in Wabanaki worldview and Mi'kmaq, and they didn't follow the protocols. So that was the response from the Mi'kmaq. But at the same time, in that letter, they also explained that the covenant chain of friendship remained strong between Washington, between the United States, and between the Mi'kmaq Nation, which I think is crucially important. There's a historian named James Kes Henderson. He calls this the One Heart Treaty. He doesn't call it the Watertown Treaty. He calls it the One Heart Treaty. And I like that, because he basically says that this maybe didn't create a military alliance like it was intended to, but what it did do was establish a relationship and establish this recognition between these nations. And from my understanding, this relationship, this recognition remains strong to this day. There's Mi'kmaq people who Mi'kmaq chiefs who've traveled down to Watertown to reaffirm this relationship in years recently. Talk about how this formation of a relationship that began in the American Revolution remains strong to this day. So that's the history immediately following the Watertown Treaty for the Mi'kmaq. Mi'kmaq, as a national consensus, from my understanding, chose to remain neutral as the national consensus. There's individual Mi'kmaq people decide to fight as young men are will do. But the history for the Wolstoboy Nation immediately following the Waratah Treaty was slightly different. So, but they too, once returning home, realized that there were things inside of that Watertown Treaty that weren't some things that they negotiated for. In the actual minutes themselves, they negotiate for prices, fixed prices, as the quote is, the same prices that the furs would fetch in Boston. And that's something that the President James Bowdoin explicitly states. And that isn't anywhere in the end minute, the end Watertown Treaty. It doesn't actually mention anything about prices out of the truck house. All it did was establish a truck house in Machias, something that was already there. All it did was resupply it, actually. Which so when the and there's actually a second letter that comes between immediately after the Watertown Treaty, where Ambrose Bierce is noted by John Allen as saying the treaty is not punctually fulfilled on the sides of the states. These prices are not being honored. And if you actually look at the treaty itself, it mentions no prices at all, despite the fact that I think it's very clear that Ambrose Bierce and the Wolskoi delegation believed that there would be prices in this agreement. So, when Allen is tasked with finding out what went wrong in Watertown, he travels up to Ekpahok. He also travels up to the Mi'kma'ki. And that's when he discovers what happened with the Mi'kmaq. And the Mi'kmaq are very clear about where they stand and their choice to remain neutral. And then he travels down to Ekpahok, which is around the current location of the town of Fredericton, around Kingsclear First Nation today. But and then they sit down, and over the course of a few weeks, hammer out a second treaty. And this second treaty is remembered as the Treaty of Eckbehock of 1777. I've also seen referred to as the Passamaquoddy-Willisquoy Treaty of 1777. There was Passamaquoddy representation there as well. And in this treaty, it's not maintained in the colonial record. So you can't find the actual wording of this treaty anywhere, unfortunately. I saw a historian suggest that there's a passage in one of Allen's letters back to the Congress where there was a trunk of letters that was stolen from him by the British, and within that trunk supposedly was the original copy of this treaty, which is unfortunate. But within those diary entries, within his letters that he explains back to Congress, he explains what was in this agreement. And what was in this agreement was prices, promised prices within that would be sold in Machias Truck House. Prices that were so favorable that once Penobscot heard, they wanted to enter the treaty as well. And this was a very favorable agreement between for Wissaquoit, Passamaquoddy to trade out of the truck house in Machias. Prices that were so favorable that once Penobscot attempted to secure the same prices within their truck house further down south, the truck house operator actually wrote to Allen saying these prices are too good. We can't honor this. This is just too one-sided for the Wabanaki. So after this trade agreement, after this new treaty and was signed, the Wissaquoi Nation, man, woman, child, got into, I think it was like 120 something canoes and traveled out to Machias to fight alongside the Continental Army. It was a battle remembered as the Battle of Machias in 1777. And Passamaquoddy and Penobscot people were there as well, and fought and defended that town from an attempted British occupation of that town, and stayed camped there for a few months following. And there were some letters in Allen's journal talking about how expensive it was to have all the entire nation, Wolosoquoy, Passamaquoddy people all camped there for so long. And that, from my understanding, the prices were honored while they were there, but once they left, the prices stopped being honored. And that became, problematic. So as far as I'm concerned, and I think likely the Wolskoi Nation considered that the broken terms of a treaty, albeit after, there's still words of peace, friendship between the Wolskoi Nation, Passamaquoddy Nation, between the United States, those prices weren't honored, but the covenant chain remained strong following that joint occupation of the town, joint military involvement. Just the up to 1777 there.
Harold, you have some comments on that?
Quickly, Zeke was mentioning James Henderson. He's known in Mi'kmaq country as Sakay Henderson. And Sakay is married to Marie Baptiste, and Marie Baptiste grew up in Houlton, Maine. And her brother, Tom Baptiste, was together with Terry Polches, the founder of the Association of Aroostook Indians when he was a student at Ricker College. And he was a very good friend of mine, Tom. And Tom also was instrumental in the helping the secure the formation of the Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaq. And that was in the 1980s. And I worked very closely with Tom. And I know how for the Mi'kmaq at Cape Breton in particular, the Treaty of Watertown became very important. And a friend of the Marie Baptiste, who had also roots at Chapel Island at Cape Breton, but she herself and her brother went to Harvard, and then she ultimately got her doctorate at Stanford. So it's an extraordinary journey that she then later made back to Mi'kmaq country at Cape Breton, and later became a professor in Canada of great notoriety. I was recently in touch with her about something. So that was a little bit about Sakay Henderson, and he was close to Alex Denny, who was at that time the Grand Captain of the Grand Council of the Mi'kmaq Nation. And he, namely Captain Denny, came to Boston in 1986, I believe, during the commemoration of the Treaty of Watertown. And by that time, the 1986, by that time, the Treaty of Watertown was already being used first by the recognition of the Houlton Band of Maliseet that at the last minute joined in the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act that had been going on since 1972 and was close to being settled. And then the Maliseet community had done the research, and one of the building blocks for the argument on the part of the Maliseet in northern Maine was precisely the Treaty of Watertown. And that's exactly what I used when I did the research for the Mi'kmaq beginning in 1981, right in the wake of Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act. And I also stumbled on the importance of the Treaty of Watertown. And so again, that was also a building block in making the argument that when the Mi'kmaq were left out from the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act of 1980, that was an uphill battle at the time, but the Treaty of Watertown was not dead. It had a strange afterlife that just when it seemed to be dead, as Zeke was just explaining, by 1777, when the Mi'kmaq at that time said, hey, this is not exactly what we agreed to. And one reason, of course, why they disagreed is not just that a number of people were not represented. Six of the Mi'kmaq villages were not represented at all at the time, but also because the Indian translator in Watertown, Captain Lithgow, there's no evidence that he either knew Maliseet or Mi'kmaq. He did know Abenaki as spoken on the Kennebec River, and the kind of Abenaki that was spoken on the Penobscot River, but he did not know, there's no evidence at all that he knew Maliseet slash Passamaquoddy, which is in essence the same language, nor Mi'kmaq, which has, of course, many regional dialects as well. So when he was appointed the translator, we have no transcript whatsoever what he was saying in the indigenous languages. And that's the bizarre thing about many of these treaties, that unlike the treaties that are made between, let's say, the Crown of Spain and England, or between France and England, it's in both languages, and then people pore over it whether that's an accurate translation. But the history of interpretations that have concepts that are circulating in English at the time among lawyers and politicians, that English speaking farmers, even in Maine, would not even know what the meaning would be, just like lawyers today have a language that most people don't understand. But then you didn't have the equivalent of that word in either Maliseet or Mi'kmaq. So one can only guess how Lithgow translated, however, he understood what was said by James Bowden, for example, who was at the council, how that was translated. And so it can only have been garbled, that's for sure. And we have no way of verifying, other than later you hear, hey, but that's not what we said, or it's not what we intended, and the translation was done wrong. And so that's an important piece when we think about treaties, that they're monolingual, almost always exclusively in English. That really hampers your understanding of what really transpired. That's number one. The second thing is that there was no wampum treaty, wampum belt that is associated either with the 1775 agreement with Chief Orono, nor with the one that was agreed upon with all the caution, caveats, if you will, caution that you have to have with what was done. But in the transcript of that one that we do have, they were published in the Baxter documents, amongst others. But there's no wampum belt. With the agreement in 77, there were wampum strings exchanged. But that was a very different one, but because that took place in Indian country and not in Massachusetts itself. So it's an interesting thing that when we contemplate these things, that A, even if a treaty is broken, it may not be dead in the sense it may have an afterlife. And this is a spectacular afterlife because it was instrumental in helping the Maliseet and Mi'kmaq in northern Maine finally get the recognition that was denied them in 1783 to 1794 when the treaty with the Passamaquoddy was made. And they were implicitly included in that 1794 treaty.
What was that 1794 treaty?
That was with the Passamaquoddy, where if you look at the language of that, it's basically almost like an afterthought by Massachusetts, because it had been dealing with the Penobscot unproductively from 1784, then again in 1786, then they gave up and were contemplating a military invasion of Indian country, the Penobscot in this case, in 1786. And it was finally concluded in 1796. But by that time, the Pessamquoddy were still unfinished business. And that came for complicated reasons, really too complicated to even discuss on any radio show, is what happened to the 1794 treaty with the Pessamquoddy. But as Zeke knows, there were other people, including Mi'kmaq and Maliseet, that John Allen is mentioning in before the 1794 treaty, that were still in the Great Lakes areas, you mean the Grand Lake area near Princeton and Machias.
Okay, so let's just recap a little bit here. We're talking about all these treaties. Okay, so when Orono shows up the year before the Watertown Treaty, Continental Congress, what was it?
Second Continental Congress.
Anyway, they agreed to recognize 6 miles on both sides of the river in that particular Orono agreement or whatever. So then we come to the Watertown Treaty. That treaty was only negotiated with the Passamaquoddy, Mi'kmaq, and Maliseets, right? Penobscot was not there to the Watertown Treaty.
No, because that's basically a follow-up on what already happened in 1775.
Okay, so after that, after Watertown, the Maliseet agreed to send help to the revolutionaries.
And
The
there were also,
Mi'kmaq
yeah,
did
Maliseet.
not.
Well, but there were some Mi'kmaq who had joined.
No, but my point is that as Zeke was saying, that the Mi'kmaq went down with the economic ideas and not had no idea that they were going to be asked to participate in a war. And they really didn't have the authority to agree to participate in a war. So when the Mi'kmaq go back, Mi'kmaq said, no, we're not going to abide by this, the Watertown Treaty. The Maliseet, on the other hand, said, yes. And so and then in 1777, they kind of renegotiated what they had been talking about in 1775. Is that correct?
I think a point that is important to add is there's an article in the Watertown Treaty that essentially says, henceforth all prior treaties with any other, nation is null and void. And I think that was a piece of it that the Mi'kmaq would likely have taken a lot of exception to. There was a long history of treaty relationship with Nova Scotia, with the British Crown, and these treaty annuities and things like provisions and gunpowder, and those things were not something that they agreed to relinquish the rights to those treaty annuities. So the suddenly that there was this treaty that came about to say that we have henceforth declared that the only relationship, any trade relationship that will be established is with the very distant colony of Massachusetts, and the only trade relationship will be through the truck house at Machias. I think that's immediately and obviously problematic. I mean, when they could, they say it themselves afterwards when Allen's, wondering what went wrong. She's attempting to understand this, and he said, "Well, frankly, that truck house at Machias is just too far away. It is too far away. We went down with the hope of getting a truck house closer, but that clearly didn't happen. And Machias is all the, Second Continental Congress, all Massachusetts was able to offer, and it was not enough."
Darren, you want to step in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think. I mean, this has been amazing regarding the complexity of the treaty. I want to sort of revisit the idea of complexity on the one hand, and then just how dramatic the changes were in this era. Like, so people, let's just assume everyone is just responding as much as they can in real time to a very fairly dramatic changing climate. The first of which happens in 1763 with the Royal Proclamation. Basically, the French no longer have a strong presence in North America, right? And that shifts things for the crown, the British crown, in the way they're seeing the development of the Western frontier. Before, they saw themselves as in competition with the French, and sort of were really encouraging a lot of kind of Western expansion. And then you have then the move towards the Revolutionary War. You have changing dynamics right in the middle of the Revolutionary War. We referenced the first bat the we didn't reference the first battle of Machias, which was basically a small is the first naval battle of the Revolutionary War in 1775. But then the second battle of Machias in 1777. But those both included Wabanaki and Patriot, American forces pushing the British out and pushing them back. That seems like a good thing, right? Of course, for the Wabanaki and the Patriots. Then you have in 1779 the Penobscot expedition, where basically the British dominate the Wabanaki and American forces in the context of the Penobscot. And so that makes people also rethink, oh, are we siding with the right horse here, right? In terms of winning and losing significant battles that are directly impacting us as Wabanaki people. So, I mean, things change as much as you have the 76 Watertown Treaty and then the renegotiations, all of that. This is a moving kind of set of discussions. And then you have the complexity of, as the Revolutionary War comes to an end, and all these promises made to, especially, the Penobscots and Passamaquoddies. These relationships are much more direct. Although, as Zeke mentioned, Colonel Allen does a lot to kind of secure as much as he can that northeastern frontier up through Port Royal, all the rest. But by then it was, we have this ongoing kind of discussions about even where, as the war comes to an end, where is the space between this newly American, United States state, and then where is that line cutting right through Wabanaki territory that separates this new entity, the United States, from the British holdings in what is now called Canada, right? So, I mean, I think you have ongoing kind of complexities of issues around who's siding with who. And then you have this really strong interest, and this is, I'm thinking about a little bit tomorrow, our panel, Donna, about the Declaration, where you have at the same time where Colonel Allen and George Washington are sending all these like missives of like, we love you, Wabanaki people, you're our best friends, and we see you as brothers. Jefferson writes in the Grievance 27 in the Declaration that Indians are merciless Indian, we're merciless Indian savages. And what they were thinking was they hated it after the Royal Proclamation that this sort of movement, westward expansion, land speculation was starting, the British Crown was starting to really pull that in. And now suddenly you have people who are wanting to do more land speculation, like, no, we don't like that. We want to have our own empire and build it out into the West. So you have to understand like the complexities of, what the Americans, the George Washington, Colonel Allen, and Thomas Jefferson, can call Indians merciless Indian savages. They're thinking out West, and then like they're trying to make it seem like they're our best buddies, within reason, on the sort of northeastern frontier, because they're trying to secure that, especially during the war, and then afterwards, related to the separation where the United States and Canada are kind of separated. And I think you see you can see that also then with the Continental the Articles of Confederation. People talk about the Watertown Treaty was never ratified, but there was no mechanism for ratification. Harold already mentioned that. Like, there was no supremacy clause of saying, like, a treaty must be signed and ratified by the Senate. That doesn't come until the Constitution, and which is goes into effect in 1789. And that also explains a lot of the kind of discourses back and forth around the attempts at treaty making in the 1780s with Penobscots and Passamaquoddies, and then later The fact that these treaties get sort of through the state of Massachusetts in the 1790s, which is in direct violation of the Non-Intercourse Act and the way that treaties are conceptualized in the Constitution, right? So you have this also complexity of like, well, they seem like we can make treaties here, really solve a lot of the legacy issues of like different claims to different deeds and titles, right? So the Royal Proclamation, the French receding, that complicates them in some ways. You have all these contradictory deeds that go back to the early 17th century and then subsequent treaties. You have all of these treaties starting in the 1790s with a more centralized United States government. Much of that is an attempt to kind of clarify title in a place now. As you get into the 1820s, a new state, quote unquote, Maine, where they also, a bunch of founders of our state also want to be land speculators, right? So they, each time they protect their interests, the colonials try to protect their interests as land speculators and as makers of empire, but also they're trying to survive through the war and make themselves, like survive the next day, right? I mean, that was, Washington's military strategy is right as well, right? Like it was like, just don't suffer a major defeat, even if you're not winning every battle. So I think like that really structures that moment. And it's also as Wabanaki folks, we're, it makes sense that on the far, the further north and east you go, the Americans, the Patriots are not making any claims to those lands. Like, why would they side with the Americans when it appears that the British are gonna control Port Royal and all the rest of Maritime Canada, whereas for us as Penobscots and as well as the Passamaquoddies, how do we maintain, a lot of those treaties from the 1790s were basically our attempts to maintain our rights to hunting and fishing in the commons. So basically, where we would always hunt and fish, while giving up sort of title, quote unquote, to vast tracts of lands. But the idea was like, we need to maintain ourselves in our places so we can feed ourselves and continue as communities. So I think there's just a lot of that complexity and like the discourses of why are people acting in this way? They use this language here. And then the next year, they use a different language to talk about Indians. And then the next year, the Mi'kmaq and Maliseets are renegotiating a treaty. Like I just want people to understand that this is a time of fairly rapid change in the kind of powers, in that there are these attempts at making and remaking, both by the newly independent Americans as well as us as Wabanaki diplomats trying to shape a future that makes sense for us and that is structured in a way about that reflects our peacemaking strategies and our understanding of the commons and how we'll feed ourselves and that sort of thing.
So there was also a push pull between the state and the federal government, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that's that tension because of, Massachusetts having treaties, in an era where despite the federal law, not only was the supremacy clause in the Constitution or the Senate, and the supremacy of treaty making, there was also this Non-Intercourse Act, which was a new federal law that says only Congress makes treaties with Indians. And despite all of that, Massachusetts seeing itself as almost a successor, as well as the Wabanaki people seeing like, who do we negotiate agreements with? It's the people in Boston, right? I mean, that's like could have been happening for the last 50 years or so. And so like people kind of entering into that thinking, perhaps that was a notion, but it's the same tension that defines the British versus American like frontier building, that who wants to control that and for what reasons, right? I mean, it becomes those same people, the Bowdens, these people who are already in negotiations starting at the end of the 18th century, who are now like, well, we're the people who are the frontier makers in Maine, and maybe Jefferson and his cronies, from Virginia, they're the frontier makers in the Ohio Valley or the, Western New York or wherever they want to move in terms of building their frontier. So there's a lot of that, like they're trying to position themselves. And I think a lot of the treaty making by Massachusetts was try to really reflect the interests of those sort of families, those people who have had those deeds, reflected in a lot of the Massachusetts kind of oriented claims and deed making.
Harold, that's your expertise, your area.
It's important. Darren was mentioning the westward expansion, and it's kind of interesting at this time of the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence to look at the centennial. And the centennial took place, of course, 100 years after the Declaration of Independence, and that was in 1876. And that centennial celebration was interrupted, if you will, because very soon after July 4th, news came from the Montana Territory of what was then called the Custer Massacre. And that was the last major victory by an indigenous coalition of warriors, in this case, Northern Cheyenne, Arapaho, and Lakota, who defeated a cavalry unit that had invaded their lands under General Armstrong Custer, and he was killed, as were his men. And that came on the heels of the end of treaty making by the United States Congress. So we talk about treaties, but that ended officially in 1871 by an act of US Congress. By that time, the United States had expanded from, and Darren was earlier mentioned the Ohio Valley, but that pretty much all the territory from the Appalachians all the way to California that had been taken from sea to sea. Later that became from sea to shining sea, but the original phrase was from sea to sea, which is a text that came from the Old Testament, from Psalms. And here you see the chosen people argument that the Jewish people had had, as articulated in the Old and New Testament, that was taken over by the Puritans. So the Puritan settlers from Massachusetts had taken over a similar kind of ideology that inspired the ancient Israelites in terms of their own taking over of territories that were at that time inhabited by the Canaanites after their banishment to Egypt. The similar kind of argument was being used by the Puritans and other American Protestant Christians to invade as God's promise, as later articulated in the Manifest Destiny, that this is all going to be country under the supervision and control and occupation of Christian nations, in particular Anglo-Protestant Christian nations. And so here in the time between 1871 and 1776, when we talk about the Treaty of Watertown, which was not ratified, as Darren just was underscoring, but the treaty that was ratified by Congress, that was with the Delaware Nation or the Lenape in 1778. That was during the Revolutionary War, and that took place at Fort Pitt on the Ohio River. And so the last treaty was with the Nez Perce. That was in the 1867 or 1868, I forgot exactly, just before US Congress decided no longer to have treaties signed with indigenous peoples, and thereby ending the recognition of indigenous peoples as sovereign nations. That's an important piece. From that moment on, even although there were still battles with the Northern Cheyenne and with the Lakota and various other groups, ending up in the massacre at Wounded Knee, which was a true horrible massacre in 1890. But here you see the genocidal intent. There's no other word for it. The genocidal intent, in spite of the 500 treaties or so that were negotiated, and actually about 370, which were ratified by US Congress, that ultimately all of them were like a series of domino stones. They were all collapsing in the grand mission of Manifest Destiny to rule this entire continent from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
So, Zeke, do you have any comments on that?
No, I'll
Just
sit back and
following,
learn
huh?
about, yeah, William and Harold and Lou and Darren earlier. Yeah, I'm just sitting here learning a lot.
Yeah, Darren, did you hear any of what Harold said?
Not really, no. Sorry, my internet went out. Yeah.
So I'm going to say something that I don't know if I should, but history, I think, kind of does repeat itself. You know, when you look at, well, actually, let me just ask you, Harold, this sea to sign the shining sea or sea to sea, And you said it was a text from the Old Testament.
Yes.
And it goes back to, and is that where manifest destiny comes from, or?
Yeah, it's in essence, manifest destiny is not the term that's being used in the Old Testament, but the concept of from sea to sea is in Psalms, amongst others, attributed to King David, who was the second king of the Israelites following King Saul. And that story is, of course, well told because King David himself was seen as the forefather of Jesus, right? And so here's a narrative that connects the Old and the New Testament in a way that later became essential to Protestantism as the Puritans had it, because they basically talked about primitive Christianity, and they didn't mean the way the term primitive is now being used, but it means prime, first Christianity. They wanted to go back to the origins of Christianity, and as reflected in the New Testament and the earliest churches, rather than what the Roman Catholic Church had created in the course of many, many centuries. And that was a return back to the texts. So both the texts of the Old Testament and the New Testament became foundational to Massachusetts as a Puritan colony. And that element is very important because the way people were thinking in the 17th century, 18th century in Massachusetts was very much biblically inspired. And they saw themselves very much as the so-called New Israelites. And that same kind of chosen people ideology that you see in the Old Testament that was picked up by Americans to this very day, right? So when we now see unabashed in this country, that kind of ideology popping up again and again and again. It's not the first time. It repeatedly pops up. And that makes, like Zeke, as someone who lives both in Canada and the United States, makes Canada a completely different country, culturally speaking, than the United States. The American culture, in broad strokes, it has many, many subdivisions. I know that, of course. But in broad strokes, that manifest destiny did not exist in Canada, nor did the notion of the Canadians as a chosen people. It's ridiculous if you would say that to a Canadian. It just doesn't exist there. And that's part of that idealism in Canada, sorry, in the United States, that has a almost embedded in it this negative dark stream that runs right through American history, that with the lofty ideals come very nasty practices.
You know, Harold, when you said that this was sort of it went back to the origins, so that to make all I could think of was to make Christianity great again. You know, it's kind of like it's circling back.
That's exactly true. And it happened earlier in the 1830s, 1840s, with the rise of the so-called Native American Party. People forget now that the term Native American is a term that is kind of thought to be as a replacement of American Indian, which became politically incorrect at one point. So people go to Native American, but the notion of Native American came in reaction against the what per was perceived, and particularly in the Boston area, Massachusetts, and in New England, was the invasion of a Roman Catholic Irish. And then later, of course, Roman Catholic Italians. And that it so this whole sense of a siege mentality that you saw developing in the early 1800s, when the nation building project of the United States was in full swing, because after the American Revolution in 1783, that idea of an American nation did not really exist. Virginia was very different from South Carolina, very different from New Hampshire, very different from Rhode Island. And there was a conglomerate of 13 former colonies that were suddenly coming under one umbrella, but it took two generations to kind of begin to forge a fabric of American culture with a national anthem, with a national poetry, with a national literature, with a national theater.
Interesting when you think about how those thoughts and those ideologies and that language sort of leaks into the future and affects things. I mean, like when you look at that phrase, you know, merciless Indian savages, and you know, that was there on purpose. right?
Well, it was a schizophrenia, really, because that was one, but at the same time, there was an idea of the vanishing Indian, right? The American Indians would disappear. And it was the rise by white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who could only be, apply for membership in so-called red man societies. The improved order of the red man rises in the 1830s, 1840s. And what they did was create tribes, in quotation marks, of only whites, Protestants, American patriots who could be member of that. And they took the names of all kind of indigenous peoples who had died or whose tribes had vanished or were still in existence. So there was a Penobscot tribe in Maine next to the real Penobscot tribe. And so it's a really bizarre coexistence that articulates a schizophrenia, as I mentioned before, the term that of the American identity. Don't forget the American Sons of Liberty disguised themselves as American Indians when they boarded the tea ships, right? And here you see this crazy idea that American Indian symbolizes freedom and liberty at the same time that that freedom and liberty was denied to the real American Indians. And that's the bizarre contradiction that you see as a red thread right through American history.
Do you have any comments, Zeke?
Well, I mean, this has
You're
gone far past my area of expertise here. But I'm listening and I'm fascinated. One of the things that kind of, from one of our earlier discussions, something that kind of popped into my head, and I guess, connected to everything we were just talking about, to rewind it back to, before the American Revolution. One of the things that I learned when I was studying British history was this idea of, British exceptionalism, the honor of being a British subject, and that being something that was not just handed out to anybody. It was, it was an honor to be included within, things like the Magna Carta, and it was an honor to be be a British subject. And then the more I kind of started thinking about that, I started to see that within the very early stages of American government. It was, this creation of a government was not a creation of government for everyone. They weren't creating this government for indigenous people, unfortunately. It was the privilege of being governed by, I just the more I considered it, the more I saw the origins of that in the United States. And at some point, the mentality changes. At some point it changes to everyone, on this soil is going to be American, whether you like it or not. But I don't think that mentality was there at the beginning. It was, but anyway, that
You
was
know
just
what? We're out of time. So, but thank you. I mean, just, and again, it just seems like we just get into something and we just come to the end. But thank you for talking about this and for joining us. We appreciate it, Zeke. Thank you for joining us for part two of America at 250, A Wabanaki Perspective. Many thanks to Harold Prince, Darren Ranko, and Zeke Crofton McDonald for sharing their knowledge and perspectives. I'm Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Wabanaki Windows.